I thought maybe as a proof of concept to first show that we can create mechanical assemblies of de novo proteins that can do constrained motion. So that's kind of like the first step for any kind of useful machines.
Welcome to the Baker Lab podcast. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington.
And I'm David Baker, the director of the UW Institute for Protein Design.
In this episode, you'll be hearing from Alexis Courbet, a researcher in the lab whose work might sound like science fiction. Inspired by the marvelous molecular machines found across the living world, Alexis is building new mechanical objects and other protein-based technologies to try to address challenges across medicine, disease diagnostics, and sustainability. As you'll soon hear, his work, rooted in protein design, is quite different than the way biotechnology normally proceeds. The molecular systems Alexis and his colleagues are building aren't modifications of what's found in nature. They're brand new objects built for a purpose. Designed atom by atom, they're also about a billion times smaller than a poppy seed.
Alexis's work was really the first demonstration that you could make design proteins with mechanical properties where you had two parts, for example, like a ring and an axle that could move around each other.
I sat down with Alexis to discuss what he's up to in the lab, the difference between science and engineering, and how he and David both feel like 21st century explorers, discovering and creating new frontiers.
So my name is Alexis Courbet, as it's pronounced in French.
How do people here pronounce it?
So people call me Alex in France. And when I moved here, I introduced myself as Alex. And then people very quickly started calling me Alexis. And then, you know, I'm very happy with that, I guess. And my last name is often butchered a bit, but that's okay. I think that's fair.
So I guess one place to start is, tell me about you. Tell me about where you're from. Where were you born?
Yeah. So I'm from Paris. I was born in the 19th arrondissement. It's like the northeast of Paris. So I did all my studies there. And then when I was around 23, I started my PhD and I moved to Montpellier to do that. So I spent most of my life in Paris and then a few years in the south of France. And then I moved to the US to work with David.
Let's take in Paris for a second. What kind of student were you?
I guess I was pretty intense, kind of obsessed and hardworking, and I guess quite curious. I guess I really wanted to take in as much as possible and learn as much as possible.
I've heard a story about you, I think when you were young, about a dodo.
So that's a funny story. I guess it's a quite romantic story in like the, you know, like the philosophical sense. I guess it's like the one of the oldest thing I can remember about my attraction for science. So as a kid, I was quite, you know, I like to observe things. I like to, you know, like look at creatures and you know, look at the sky and like dream about things. I was quite a curious kid, I guess. And so, you know, often during the weekend, like the thing that I would ask to do is to go to museums with my parents, right? That was like the typical Sunday afternoon. So we went to this, we used to go to this beautiful museum in Paris. It's called the Museum of Natural History. It's a really beautiful place, you know, kind of like in the big tradition of naturalists from the 18th century. Actually, I highly recommend people to go there. So anyways, I was quite fascinated by this place because there's an amazing collection of different creatures and like taxidermist animals and a lot of like very, very cool things and facts about the universe. Anyways, there is this gallery there. It's called the Gallery of Evolution. And so it has hundreds and hundreds of different animals from all around the world, kind of like trying to showcase the evolutionary history of the Earth. And there was this bird. There was a dodo bird. And I don't know why, for some reason, as a kid, I was absolutely fascinated by this bird. You know, and I saw it and I was completely obsessed and I, you know, kept talking about it. And my parents were kind of quiet about it. And at one point, that, you know, they tell me, well, you know, actually, like, it doesn't exist anymore. And I didn't really understand at first and I was quite devastated by that. I think that kind of made me realize that, you know, very interesting things can disappear. And there's so much time you have to like explore and discover and understand the world. And I think it's the first time I kind of felt this like urgency to like, you know, go out in the world and discover things.
I've also heard that you had a lot of engineers in your family. You didn't become an engineer exactly, or maybe you now have, but you ended up in science and interested in medicine.
Yeah.
Can you sort of thread that for me?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually it's interesting. So pretty much all of my close families, they're all engineers. My dad, mother, brother, grandfather and such. And so I kind of grew up in that culture. My dad is a physicist and a aerospace engineer, and my mom is also an aerospace engineer, and my brother is a software engineer. You know, does like AI things and such. But very engineering, you know, vibes as I was growing up. And I guess I was a little more broadly curious, I guess. And I was really like, you know, fascinated by living creatures. And complexity in general, and you know, simply just building things was not enough. I guess I was drawn to medicine early on because it seemed very, you know, theoretically interesting. Because like you have to understand a lot about human biology, about biochemistry, about interactions between humans and you know animals and the world and such. So I was really drawn to that, and. So I went into medical studies and I was pretty happy at first, you know, learning about a lot of things. But then less and less so by like just, you know, like catalogs of like things and protocols and stuff like that. And I realized pretty quick that I just absolutely did not like to interact with patients. So you know, I realized that and then I quickly pivoted and went back to like, you know, hard sciences.
Can I ask you about that pivot? I think that's not uncommon when people are in school and sort of young and trying to figure out what they want to do. Was that unsettling that I thought I was going to get into medicine and be a doctor and I'm discovering it's not for me?
You know, maybe it's weird, but I always felt like things were logical. I didn't look back at all. And I think... I always felt like there was only one thing that I wanted to do. And, you know, I wouldn't see myself doing anything else but science. I'm not sure if that's a common thing, but no, I never looked back. I'm very happy that I went this way. It's very rewarding.
That's super interesting. I would love to hear more about what that one thing is. What has seemed like the thing you wanted to spend your time doing or the thing that's like held your fascination?
There's so many things you can do in life, but there's few that are really worth pursuing, I think. And, you know, early on, I realized that just exploring and discovering and understanding life and the universe was like the only thing really worth doing. It's a little crazy, but that's how I felt. And more specifically, you know, like I was very interested by life in general, I guess. And that's something that has kept fascinating me for forever. So trying to understand the underlying principle by which life operates. And so first of all, understand them and then replicate them in synthetic system is something that I've always thought was the most interesting to pursue.
We talked a bit about the engineers in your family, and it makes me think, working in the area of science that we do in protein design, sometimes it feels like pure discovery, fundamental science, and sometimes it feels a lot like engineering. And I think a lot of times it's both. Engineering disciplines are characterized or caricaturized as very rigid, very math-driven, whereas sciences and certainly biology sometimes has this connotation of opposing the rigid order of engineering and the squishiness of biology.
Right.
And with the work you do now, you're kind of doing both.
Right.
Do you see your work as trying to squeeze those two things together?
Right. So engineering is, you know, it's very goal-oriented. So you're trying to build something, a tool of some sort. It's very satisfying, right? It's like you spend time working on a problem and you solve it and then you get your reward. I think there's so much more when you do more of this like fundamental biological sciences because so not only you work on a problem you're trying to solve, but then you always discover more and more, right? So it's like a never-ending pursuit of curiosity and discovery and exploration, really. So I think it's very interesting. So there's something about biology that is that differentiated from engineering, because you have this absolutely gigantic parameter space. So if you want to do anything, you have to navigate these very complex landscapes. That's where there's something about intuition. So it's not only engineering, but it's also like a design aspect, obviously, in what we do. Also, like mostly what we do is just driven by fun and curiosity. And I think it's very special.
We keep coming back to this theme of exploration. And I think an important detail of your work, as I understand it, is that you're not out here exploring new continents, but your exploration is really, really small. You spend a lot of time in the nanoscale. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if I had lived in the 18th century, I would probably be on a boat somewhere. But then in the 21st century, there's not so much left you can explore, I guess, at the macro scale. So now you can just sit on a computer and just explore this incredible universe of atoms and, and proteins and such. And it's just incredible. Now you can actually create things, at the atomic scale. It's an incredible universe that we have access to.
Does that feel like exploring? When you start a new project, you think of yourself a bit as on some tiny little boat?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, every day when I just sit on my computer, I'm like, oh, well, what am I going to do and discover today? And there's an element of exploration like that is so exciting. So you can, you spend your time on your computer designing, and then you create something, and then you put that gene in a cell. The cell makes that the protein that you've designed, and then you can take that protein and look at it under a microscope, and you can see single atoms and such. It's absolutely incredible. And if that's not exploration, I don't know what is. Yeah.
I feel very much the same way. I feel like we're the equivalent of, maybe 16th century explorers trying to chart unknown territories. And it's true, the Earth is pretty well mapped, but the frontiers of science, particularly in our area where there's so much to discover and create, are, I think, they're the 21st century equivalents. I'd say go one step further. I think the early explorers like Magellan were discovering what was already there, but hadn't been found yet. I think we are actually creating new things that wouldn't have been there if we hadn't created them. So it's not only are we discovering new worlds, but we're making them. Every time you make a new breakthrough or create a new type of functionality, it opens the doors to so many new things that you can build upon. And we see that all the time here, that someone will make a breakthrough and then all these new shoots will come that go in completely new directions that we really didn't anticipate it when we were working on that first breakthrough.
So let's get into the details here. So you've worked on a couple different projects in your time in the Baker Lab and here at the IPD. I can see that there's a theme to them, but I think at first glance, they look very different from one another. So maybe we'll just go in order. When you showed up here to do protein design, take me into the first project that you did here.
Yeah. So maybe I should backtrack and just start maybe a little earlier. So,
sure.
So I was very interested by complexity of life and such. And so I wanted to work in that field. And I was early drawn by, at the time, what we call synthetic biology. So that is the idea that you can start reusing biological components and putting them together in a synthetic approach and create things that are biological, but I can do, man-made design tasks. What I was trying to do essentially is design biochemical circuits that could do useful computation. So, cells can do computation, very simple one, also very complex ones, right? So from cells to brains, there's a huge difference in terms of what we can compute. And so at the time, what I did essentially is trying to prove that we could, by design, create new logic functions that we could encode into cells to essentially force them to compute Boolean functions of interest.
So help me understand what that might look like, practically speaking, either in a system you built or one on a whiteboard. What would it mean for a cell to compute anything?
So, the way diagnostics works in medicine is that you have a bunch of biomarkers that you're trying to measure. And then depending on the concentration of those biomarkers, you will inform the decision-making, the medical decision-making.
So this is maybe this patient has something wrong with their kidneys, but we don't know. So let's measure these so-called biomarkers, maybe in their blood or whatever.
Exactly. Okay. So there will be one biomarker that will be at very high concentration, another one that'd be at very low concentration. And then the combination of both those biomarkers essentially is going to be an indication of some disease.
I see. Almost like a fingerprint.
Exactly. And so the idea we had is to essentially embed these medical diagnostic algorithms inside biochemical circuits that essentially can compute those diagnostic algorithms.
So there's no wires in the cell, but instead we're talking about molecules that are functionally carrying out the same task. So they've got to detect something, like maybe a chemical. They've got to relay the fact that they detected it to something else. That's kind of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, exactly. And so there's different ways you can do it. And during my PhD, I kind of explored two approaches. One of them is to use gene circuits. So essentially, you can encode this circuit inside of genes. And then you can have expression of a gene as a function of the environment of the cell. Essentially, you can write down Boolean logic operation inside the cell using only genes.
So that would be like, in a circuit I'm more familiar with, something in an electrical system, you might configure something, flip a switch, and there's a light bulb that's part of the circuit, and the light bulb turns on because of the switch. And here we're talking about linking the presence of a chemical through this biological circuit that, instead of a light bulb, turns on a gene.
Exactly.
Got it.
And the typical gene we use, is the fluorescent gene, like GFP.
Oh, so it is a light bulb.
Yeah, it is a light bulb. Nanoscale okay. light bulb.
So you said a point about that work, though, is that you're clearly building something. You were doing design work.
Yeah.
But the pieces you were building with, where did those come from?
Right. So exactly. So we're essentially reorganizing natural biological matter in ways that are useful. So we were using DNA and enzymes, and all these things have been in nature for a while. So that worked, but at least for me at the time, I was a little frustrated because it wasn't really fully synthetic biology, right? It was it was getting there, but
it's like remixed biology.
Exactly. Yeah.
I see.
But I was kind of like frustrated when I finished my PhD because at the time we could essentially only reuse already existing natural components that had evolved for billions of years, essentially, right? So I wanted to find a way to create things that are even more de novo, right? Really synthetic biological components. And at the time, so that was in 2016, there was really only one lab in the world that was doing that. And that was David Baker's lab. So like protein design was just essentially just starting, had been started for like, a decade or so. And it was starting to work. And I was absolutely fascinated by this field.
So then talk about this. Let's go back to this this time, that frustration of building that way and showing up here to do what you call de novo design. That's a term that we use in a lot of our scientific papers. But if I've never heard that before, what are you actually talking about? What does that mean?
Right. So it means that you essentially create biological molecules that have never been in nature before and that have completely, bypassed evolution. And essentially it means that we have understood the physics, or at least some of the physics by which these things can fold and can be synthesized. So we understand the underlying principles so well that now we can create new one. And so David Baker likes to use that term, post-evolutionary biology, which I think is a very good one.
Post-evolutionary biology.
Not sure you've heard that before, but
yeah, it's interesting.
Up until fairly recently, the only proteins we knew came through evolution. And post-evolutionary biology, I think, describes really well the exciting state of protein design, where we can create new proteins to do exactly what we want, rather than scavenging around nature for a protein which has a function which is useful for us.
Evolution, I think a lot of people think, is just something that happened in the past. Or maybe there's a sense that, well, yeah, it's still happening, but it's slow. But I think also if you work in the field, you kind of quickly discover evolution can also be a tool. It can also be a thing that people do in the lab, like procedures called directed evolution or artificial evolution. And so some researchers who are trying to do work that's kind of similar to yours, they do directed evolution, they do artificial evolution, but that's not what's happening with your work, right? So can you tease that apart for me?
Right. So directed evolution is an incredibly powerful tool. There's no question about that. And, you know, Francis Arnold called the Nobel Prize for that. And that's very exciting for everyone. But, you know, as powerful as it is, there are limits to what you can do with it, right? So if you wanted to build a plane, for example, you're not going to just evolve it. At some point, the primary space is so big that you won't be able to just navigate it by evolution, unless you've got like millions of years on your hands. But yeah, at some point, there are things that can be built only by design. And this is why we're here.
Very cool. So let's get into the projects you worked on while you were here. Let's talk about the first one. How did your work in the Baker Lab start? What were you trying to do?
Right. So, okay. So after I finished my PhD, I was, you know, I was telling you, I worked in essentially designing information processing system in using biological molecule. And when I moved here, I wanted to do the same, but starting fully de novo. So designing molecules from scratch that can interact with each other to try to compute useful functions.
Creating brand new nanoscopic machines that are also computers.
Exactly.
That sounds super easy.
Yeah, exactly. It's very easy. And so quickly I realized that that would be quite challenging. Absolutely not impossible though, but I thought the first good step maybe as a proof of concept is to first show that we can create mechanical assemblies of de novo proteins that can do some like, you know, constrained motion essentially. So that's kind of like the first step for any kind of like useful machines.
Are you using that word metaphorically? You say machine, or do you mean literally a machine?
Oh, it's literally a machine.
Like if I looked at it, like it we're talking about a physical object, super small. It's made of carbon and other atoms, and it has parts and they like spin and interact.
Right. So a machine is essentially an assembly that changes the magnitude and direction of a force. Right. Okay. So that's what like cells do, like, you know, from enzymes to, you know, like rotary machines and such like that. Essentially what they do is that they transfer chemical energy into work. One of the great example of motors and machines in biology is like ATPase or other very complex rotary assemblies. They convert chemical energy, so often it's ATP. They convert that into motion, into rotary motion.
I happen to know you built some rotors.
Right.
Some assemblies. I think this is actually really hard to wrap your mind around, or I was just like astonished when I first saw these things. So sort of paint me a picture. What are the objects that you built? What do they look like?
Right. Okay, so I design highly symmetric assemblies of proteins. And so essentially what it looks like is you have an axle machine part and then a rotary machine part that comes around this axle. And then you have a rotational degree of freedom between the two parts. It spins. And not only it spins, but we showed that you could control how it spins by essentially sculpting the energy landscape of interaction between the building blocks.
Kind of like a tight fit or a looser fit. Or you could make, you know, I'm almost picturing like gears, like clicking a little bit and then a little bit more and then a little bit more. Is that what we're talking about?
Exactly. So it's like essentially like nanoscale gears. And in that case, the gears are just interactions of like, you know, atoms of amino acids between the proteins.
Alexey's work was really the first demonstration that you could make design proteins with mechanical properties where you had two parts, for example, like a ring and an axle that could move around each other.
So the atoms are a big part. So this is the truly mind-blowing thing, because actually I've looked under a car maybe one or two times. I think I've seen an axle before, but you're talking about really like an unimaginably small physical object. Can you help me understand in physical scale? What are we talking about here?
Right. So here we're talking about, so like some of the biggest rotary machines I've designed are around 20 nanometers, and the smallest ones, a couple nanometers.
20 nanometers. So for, in case you don't recall, one nanometer is a billionth of a meter.
That's right.
So we are pretty close to the limit of what you could physically bunch a few atoms together to build.
That's right. Well, so what's very cool about proteins is that you can essentially control placement of atoms, you know, at the atomic scale. And that's an amazing thing that biology discovered, right? So as we all know, it's very, very hard to fabricate things at a nanoscale.
So I remember this paper, I think it was published in 2022, Computational Design of Mechanically Coupled Axle Rotor Protein Assemblies. For folks listening, if you want to check out the paper, skim the figures. They're just gorgeous. Like you'll see actually what we've been talking about, these axles and rotors and these things piecing together. We talked about these assemblies, they can spin, they can rotate in different ways. And you spend a lot of time in the paper measuring that, mm-hmm. showing that they spin and they move, and like even quantifying how they move and their tendencies and directions and stuff. How do you do experiments like that?
So, interesting actually, because I think we've come to a point where design is almost easy, but then biophysics and measurements are very hard. Mm. That was actually very difficult. And so we essentially mostly used very, very high resolution microscopes, cryo-electron microscopes, to shoot electrons at those rotary motors, and then essentially reconstruct the structures of the different states. And doing this, we could essentially see how they move. And of course, we worked on like a lot of different other approaches to measure, the mechanical properties. And so those rely on very complex and sophisticated optical microscopes. We're still working on many of those approaches, and it's definitely not easy.
Very cool. Before we move on from these machines and rotors, why do this work? I mean, yeah. It's really cool. I'm just sort of geeking out about it, but like, let's say we got really good at fabricating these types of really, really unimaginably small objects. Are they useful? What could you do with stuff like this?
Yeah. Right. That's the question. So not only it's fun, but at some point it might be extremely useful. You could think, for example, in medicine, people have dreamt about, fabricating nanorobots to do some very complex, tasks in the body, right? And so far it's been absolutely inaccessible. But I don't think we're very far from being able to design like robot-like assemblies of proteins that can do very specific tasks. For example, going into your bloodstream and then destroying pathological cells, or fixing some kind of like pathological defect in your body.
That is incredible. With these nanomachines, but that's not the only thing you've worked on in your time here, right? Can you tell me sort of about the next chunk of research you've been working on?
Yeah, absolutely. So I worked on that for a couple of years, and also other, AI approaches for design with a lot of my colleagues, which is really, really fun. And so, I mean, as we all know, AI really changed the game, right? Like now it's so much, easier and faster to design very complex assemblies of proteins. And so after we worked on those new methods, I was very interested to like apply those to design things that are like intersection of what I'm passionate about in terms of science, but also something useful. So there's a field of research that's the intersection between biochemistry and electronics, right? So this idea that you can functionalize electronics with de novo proteins and essentially combine what biochemistry does best, that is atomically precise function, so binding, catalysis, and such, and combine that with what electronics does best, that is information processing.
The exciting general area is being able to couple biology with electronics. And so for things like sensing, when receptors in our noses sense molecules, they're connected through an elaborate system of neural circuitry to our brain where that's read out. And of course, we use electronic devices like cell phones all the time, but there's no way to connect sensing of a small molecule with an electronic readout, or at least a simple way. If we could put protein sensors for small molecules directly into silicon nitride chips, it would open the door for a sort of a direct marrying of biology and electronics.
So this is another one that to me is like mind-blowing. You're talking about like building a bridge, metaphorically, a bridge that connects biology, living cells and the chemicals and molecules that they make with computers, like silicone digital type devices. Is that what we're talking about?
Right. So people have dreamt about that for a while, but it's really the interface that is very important to engineer here. And so it's been very difficult so far because we only could rely on natural proteins. And so it's very hard to take those natural proteins and then integrate them with silicone, right? Mm. Because they were not evolved for that. So now for the first time, essentially, we can design silicone chips according to the specifications we want, but also we can design de novo proteins with the specifications we want, and we can design those to essentially have the right properties to go and functionalize silicone.
Can you sort of paint a picture with words of like a silicone chip that has a designed protein in it? What are we even talking about? What does that look like?
Okay, so there's many ways in which you could integrate biochemistry with electronics. The way we do it now in the lab is, so essentially we fabricate solid state pores inside the silicone chips. So essentially very, very tiny holes, round holes. And then we design proteins that look like, so they are nanopores.
So the protein's kind of like a tube. Right?
Exactly. It looks like a tube.
Or like a barrel even.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then you said these holes, like you drill the holes? What are these holes?
Right. So we can, use like the gold standard lithographic techniques to design the features we need in the silicone.
Okay.
And so that's been around for decades. And so that's scalable, that's cheap, mm-hmm. that's very easy to do. So we design these proteins to have exactly the right biochemical features to interact with the silicone, dock there, bind, and stay stably incorporated inside the silicone. And so what happens then is that you have an atomically defined hole, so what we call a nanopore, inside the silicone chip. And that functions as an incredibly sensitive single molecule detector, right? So as you have molecules going through this nanopore constriction, then you have a change of current. And so this is what we measure.
Mm.
And so essentially we have a coupling between the biochemistry to like a readout that's electronic, that is the current, and that's extremely sensitive and fast and extremely scalable.
Wow. So we're picturing a device where if it's just silicone, it's got a hole drilled into it. And it, as if I understand it right, the hole that we're physically drilling or manufacturing, that's like just about as small hole as one could drill, right?
Like yeah.
It's pretty hard to make things that are much narrower than that hole, right?
Well, so as you do lithography, there's like a variability in like essentially the features you can create in silicone. So people have thought about, doing this for decades, and they were having trouble because they were relying on natural proteins. And so they could not really get to design the right shape, the right biochemistry to essentially functionalize those features that have variable sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't use the smallest feature sizes because we don't really need to. So we use feature sizes that are more reliable essentially. And then we design proteins to reliably functionalize those silicone chips.
There's something like deliciously mechanical about all this to me that I always just find fascinating about your work. So one way that I think about it is, so there's a gap in the silicone, which mm-hmm. could allow, let's say, electric currents to flow through. And it's like, it's a nanoscale device, but on the scale of atoms, it's a pretty gaping gap. It's pretty big. There's a lot of current flowing through.
Yeah.
And you're talking about you put one of these barrel-like proteins, stuff it into that hole. It's just the right size. And the protein itself has an even narrower, but much more precise channel, a mm-hmm. hole in that like tube. And it's still going to let some of those electrons let that current through. But now it's a way more precise system.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about milliamps? Or I'm not an electrical engineer, mm-hmm. clearly, but like, is this at all similar to what you might find in a normal electronic device, or right. is this on a much, much smaller scale?
So actually we're talking picoamps. It's quite magical, like the precision we can get in terms of measurement. So we measure picoamps at thousands of hertz.
I'm sure the electrical engineers listening have their minds blown right now. And you talked about these things being sensors. How are they sensors?
Right. So you have this small constriction, and so essentially you constantly monitor the current going through this protein constriction that's atomically defined by the protein fold. And so what happens is that when you have a molecule that goes through that constriction, you essentially block the flow of ions, and so the the consequence of that is that you can measure a change of current.
So the object you hope to detect is physically blocking the tube.
Exactly.
And that changes the electrical properties of the system.
Exactly.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit. What is a normal day doing this kind of work, this kind of research, actually look like for you?
So I wake up at around 8 in general. And what I like to do is drink a coffee and play a bit of piano or guitar. That's like my daily routine.
You play both?
Yeah, I started playing a guitar like a year ago.
And
I like it a lot, actually. It's more portable, so more interesting for the backcountry, you know, than a piano. So yeah, I usually spend a few minutes playing my instrument and then drink my coffee and then I head to work. And first thing I do is like check on the jobs, right? So every night before I leave, I run, you know, I start a bunch of like computational jobs, right?
They're what, like attempting to design some part of a molecule, or you're running some analysis of some protein on the computer?
Yeah, either analysis or most often just designing, you know, testing new approaches for designing a specific fold, new algorithms, you know, new methods. And so I always run something before I leave. And then in the morning, I just, you know, I come to my computer and I have my coffee and I'm very excited to see what happened.
So you and the computer working around the clock.
Yeah. And then I you know, I check my emails and then I start my day with like talking to my colleagues and coworkers. I plan the day and go with the, you know, with the week and plan experiments. And then usually in the afternoon, I like to sit down and try to do some more focused computational work. So usually like, you know, writing code or taking like an hour or two of focused work for a specific problem. And that's often, you know, interspaced with different kinds of experiments.
So like a lot of people here, you spend a chunk of time in the digital world, writing code and running it and making molecules. And also you're in the laboratory, physically making the proteins and watching them spin.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
What is something that you like about being a scientist? And what is something that you don't like about it?
Well, what I like is that it's incredibly rewarding and fun. Like you never get bored, you know? You don't get bored, but sometimes it's a little much in the sense that, like, you know, you can easily get obsessed about what you do, and that takes a good chunk of your life, which I don't think is a bad thing, but it's sometimes I guess it's a bit of like, maybe, I don't know if sacrifice is the right term, but definitely it's a commitment, right? At least for me.
Can you tell me about what does that look like for you? Do you find yourself obsessed with things sometimes?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you work on a fun project or like something that you're working very hard on, you know, I would spend my whole night dreaming about it.
Nightmares?
Not nightmares.
Kind of dream where you're like, oh, I figured it out.
Yeah, literally. And sometimes, like literally I would dream that I'm like, you know, writing a piece of code for something, or like I'm dreaming about doing some specific experiments. And sometimes, surprisingly, I actually find solutions when I dream about things that I should do the next day.
Wow.
It's kind of rare, but that has happened and it's interesting. So yeah, that's what I mean by obsession.
That sounds like obsession to me. Have you ever started over or made a big change in your life? And if so, tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like moving from France to Seattle was a big deal for me. My whole family is in Paris, and I've lived in Seattle for a little more than 8 years now. And that's definitely a big deal. Culture is very different, obviously, and pretty far from what I know and from my family. So that was a big move for sure. But I absolutely don't regret, because I've made amazing connections and friendships here. And, you know, like my working life is really, really rewarding. And it's a beautiful place to live in, right? So that's also why I moved here, by the way, because of the world-class science and David, and also because of the incredible outdoor opportunities all around. So it's a very, very special place in my heart. There's really everything I love, and it'd be hard to think of a better place to live in the world. Yeah.
So So for those who don't know, the guy who runs this lab, David Baker, he's a bit of an outdoors kind of guy.
A little bit, yeah.
Skier and a hiker. And I think that's a little bit of the lab culture here. We do a lot of, we do ski trips and hiking trips occasionally because, like you're saying,
yeah,
the state of Washington has tons of mountains and gorgeous places to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of the lab culture has attracted some like outdoorsy type people who sort of fit in with that. And I've seen a lot of those people come and go, but I think you, Alexi, you're like one of the more hardcore outdoor people. Can you, and I've seen some amazing photos you've taken with you and David and other people of the lab mm-hmm. who've gone on some pretty epic trips. Do any of those stand out in your mind of like a big trip you've gone on with maybe David and others? And then also, what do you talk about when you're spending multiple days trudging up a mountain with your boss who just won a Nobel Prize?
Yeah, you know, okay. So, I mean, it's a very special thing. We have a relationship with the mountain and science.
There are always surprises working with Alexi. We went for a really exciting backcountry ski trip last month. And at a certain point, he pulled out a snack, of which he offered me a big piece, and I took it and bit into it. And then he explained that it was 80% beef fat and 20% blueberries. And I think there was another ingredient, some kind of nut. And needless to say, it tasted like it was about 80% beef fat. So I was not able to actually finish my, it's called pemmican.
I mean, David was very generous about it. Like he showed me a lot of this and it was very special for me. It was very, very, very fun. And you know, like the time we spend in the mountain, we oscillate between discussions about science and, you know, philosophy and nature, and simply just like being there and observing the landscape.
In your opinion, what makes somebody a good scientist?
To do good science, I think you have mostly to have a talent to ask the right questions, right? And, you know, of course, like, you know, you can be smart or that definitely helps. but I think the best virtues to become a good scientist is to just have the right compass to find what is truly interesting and valuable. So asking the right questions. And then I would say to be a good scientist, you also have to just be generally fair and kind.
Is science, at least as a job, the way you imagined it would be when you started, or has it surprised you maybe in a way you didn't expect?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I never really thought about that. I kind of like follow what interests me, but I never thought I was going to become an academic, you know? And sometimes I'm a little surprised or rubbed the wrong way by the academic culture. Sometimes I'm not sure I fully belong to that culture. I think there's two different aspects in academia. There's the career aspect, and then it's like the passion for science. Sometimes those are quite antagonistic, right?
Mm.
In the sense that there's different ways to advance. Is either to focus too much on your career or too much of the science. And so it's sometimes a very hard job to like kind of like balance those two. You know, I see some early career scientists that kind of get trapped in their career path, and they kind of like stop doing the science that they love, right? Because they have to apply for the grants, they have to find the money where it is. It's, you know, it's very hard to navigate the space in a way that allows you to do the science you love and also essentially get an academic job. So often you get trapped in, you know, kind of like reporting to administration or to your funding agencies, and you sometimes can lose this kind of freedom that drives you. I think it's very important for early career scientists to find the right path for them to be able to express themselves scientifically. There's so many things to do in life, I would say. Getting an academic job is great, but finding the right one is even better.
If you were talking to someone much younger than yourself who was maybe still in school and interested in this type of work that you do, do you have any advice you give a person like that?
I guess maybe that sounds cliche, but I would say really follow what brings you joy, right? Again, there's so many things one can do in life. And, you know, science can be hard and it's pretty tough. And the most important thing is to enjoy it, I think, to be successful. So maybe that sounds cliche, but I think this is very important to remember. Enjoy the process. That's the key thing, right? And also I would say, like, just always keeping some perspective of like, what's your place in society, and remembering that, you know, things don't have to be so serious all the time. It's really about enjoying the process.
Yeah, I heard there's a music piece that you might want to include. Can you tell me about it?
Oh, sure. So it's a piece by Claude Debussy. It's called Clair de Lune. And so I think it's interesting because it's like this kind of like musical transition between the Romantic period to modernity at the end of the 19th century, I think. This just really captures like the vibe of the end of the century. And I feel like we're kind of like in this transition period now where we're exiting like just like traditional modernity and getting into like an AI world. And so I feel like there's like an echo of the past, I guess. And I think this music captures that pretty well. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks for listening to the Baker Lab podcast. Your host this episode was Ian Hayden. This episode was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington School of Medicine. It was produced by Anisha Sagal, Nora McNamara Bordwick, Rithi Biswas, Ian Hayden, and Roni Weissman, with help from Joe Min and Nathan Greenwood. Our intro music is by Kevin MacLeod. Please subscribe and leave a rating if you like this show, and we'll see you next time.